Coming out on Saturday on Beyond the Vibe, I'm joined by Chris Robertson of Blackstone Cherry.
When your first album came out, I was 12, so...
I don't feel old as fuck now. That's all good. Thanks a whole lot. No, that stuff's so cool to me, man. You know, because you got to think about it from my perspective too, man. Mm. As a 20-year-old kid recording that record, you know, the debut record that came out in 06, and that record came out 2 months after my 21st birthday. Mm. And the fact that there were 12, 13-year-old kids like you going out buying that thing, man. That's the thing that's so cool to me, man. Like, it makes you feel old as hell when somebody's like, I was 12 and now I'm like almost, I'm pushing 30. And I'm like,
yeah,
fuck off, man. It's great. I'm old. We can turn this thing around. But you can't judge a book looking at the cover. And I think this is the most honest record we've ever made. And especially on the lyric. Side, you know, we all write together, but I think that this record, it was just kind of like, we're not going to dance around anything that we got to say, we're just going to say it.
So I'm here with Chris Robertson of Blackstone Cherry. Thank you very much for joining me.
Hey man, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, of course, you have this brand new album, Screaming at the Sky, coming out on September 29th, which we'll absolutely be diving into. But first, I feel to really get a picture of an artist, you have to kind of look at how things began for them. So what first got you into wanting to become a musician?
My dad, and my grandpa being musicians. My dad played locally back home his whole life, you know, just doing cover band stuff at kind of country dance halls, things like that. My grandpa played bluegrass locally back home and built acoustic instruments. I think, like, you know, any kid that's fortunate enough to have a good role model as a male figure in their life, that I just wanted to be like my dad.
Obviously, like, growing up, I mean, I feel growing up, everybody has that band that they really connect with, that first band that was their band. Did you have that?
Man, for me, the first band I ever remember hearing as a child, and it's always stuck with me, is the one on my hat. It's Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I was riding around with my dad in his pickup truck, you know, and we were listening to One More from the Road on cassette, and it was badass, man.
It's interesting because, like, I mean, when I was growing up, like, you guys were one of my kind of first bands that were like my band. Like, when your first album came out, I was 12. So,
I don't feel old as fuck now. That's all good. Thanks a whole lot. I feel old as shit. No, I'm joking, man. That stuff's so cool to me, man. You know, because you got to think about it from my perspective, too, man. Mm. As a 20-year-old kid recording that record, yeah. You know, the debut record that came out in 06, and that record came out 2 months after my 21st birthday. Mm. And the fact that there were 12, 13-year-old kids like you going out and buying that thing, man, and like downloading it on LimeWire or wherever the hell you were doing, you know, who cares at this point? But like the fact that there were kids actively going out and getting that, that's the thing that's so cool to me, man. Like it makes you feel old as hell when somebody's like, I was 12 and now I'm like almost, I'm pushing 30. And I'm like,
yeah.
Fuck off, man. It's great. I'm old.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the first CDs I ever owned. I have the two up there. Still with me now. It's kind
That's
of a
awesome,
nice full circle moment.
That's awesome.
I mean, from a fan perspective, it seemed like you guys had kind of come out of nowhere and you just kind of became one of these top young bands. But I imagine from your perspective, it was kind of this gradual build. So what was this period like for you? As you mentioned there, it's like, you know, you have these young people all of a sudden listening to your music, but, you know,
man,
it doesn't happen overnight.
Man, we were an opening band in the States everywhere we went, you know, and still are in some regards, you know, we still open a lot of shows. And then we came to Europe, supporting Hinder and expected to go back again and support someone else, but we got an offer to come back and headline. And when we came back over, we did a lot of the rooms that we're doing this coming September, this month. And a lot of them got close to selling out or, you know, pretty close. And we were like, hang on a minute. Something different over here. Something about the folks over here across the pond on this island really like us. And this is odd, but we're just going to go with it. And it, you know, it was something that was absolutely beautiful for us at the time because, you know, we'd been in the band since 2001, came over for the first time in 2007, and then later that year to come back and headline and have more people show up to see us, you know, several thousand miles from home than we did when we would play in Nashville or Louisville was quite an experience for us. You know, and it still is to this day. It's still something that we don't take for granted. We don't take it lightly that, you know, we're able to be four country ass hillbillies from South Central Kentucky and, you know, travel across the ocean and come play rock and roll for a living. It's pretty cool, man. You know, and I'm very thankful for it.
I mean, one of the things that I hear and many, many times, you know, seeing the comments, you have this real kind of recognizable and individual voice. Is this something that you've always had? And like, were you always going to be a front man or was that something that you just fell into?
Part one, my voice has just always kind of been shitty like this. Part two of that, I never wanted to sing. I didn't, man. Like, as much as I admire Ronnie Van Zant and, you know, the vocals of Lynyrd Skynyrd, it was the guitars that drew me in, man. Like, I wanted to be Alan Collins or Gary Rossington, you know, up there playing a guitar. Like, but I didn't turn out to be tall and skinny like Alan Collins, so that wasn't going to work out for me. So, I wanted to be a guitar player, man. I wanted to be the guy that played guitar, you know, and played the guitar solo every now and then. You know, I didn't want to be Slash, but I wanted to do what Slash did, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then we couldn't find anybody to sing. And I could remember all the words. And they said, Chris, you're the only one that doesn't sound like somebody else that's already in a band. Mm. You know, you're the only one that sounds different than other people. You got a different sound. And I kind of just got the gig put on me, you know, and it was really hard at first, but I've grown to love, you know, my role is singing. And the frontman thing is like, I'm never going to be, you know, David Lee Roth or even Brent from Shinedown or guys like that. You know, that was never my calling in life. I don't feel like I always wanted to be playing guitar, and then now I want to be playing guitar and singing, you know, but the way I do it, man, is I have a good time and I try to make sure the crowd's having a good time and do that, you know. But as far as wanting to sing or be the front man or any of that, hell no, I didn't want to do it. But it, you know, I enjoy it now and I'm very thankful for the opportunity I was given.
I mean, you wouldn't believe on this show, it's a common theme. The reluctant singer that does it for like one or two nights, I'll just fill in for a bit. And then here we are like 20 years later.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I don't know if that's, I don't know what it is. If it's just something where like, where we don't want to do it, we do it different. And they're like, oh, that's cool. And I'm like, God damn it.
So obviously your up and coming album, Screaming at the Sky, it's your eighth studio album. And, you know, in my research for this episode, the thesis of this record is about adapting and moving on. You know, it feels like a bit of a personal album. So what does this album mean to you, and what's that kind of overall message that you're trying to get across?
I think more than anything, and I've said this a lot, but it's the truest statement. I think this is the most honest record we've ever made, and especially on the lyrical side. You know, we all write together, but I think that this record, it was just kind of like, we're not going to dance around anything that we got to say. We're just going to say it, you know, and be brutally honest about it. And that's where we went with it. You know, it's very reflective and looking in and moving on and having to let go and adapt to change and all the really fun shit that you just can't wait to do when you wake up in the morning. Now, all the stuff you don't want to do, and like, you know, the goodbyes you don't want to have to say, you know, to the people that you love, and those relationships that just end, you know, and are what they are. And this record's all of that, though, man. It's the truth of the last couple of years of what we've all lived together.
I mean, I hear a bit of that in the track, one of the singles, Nervous. There's these kind of themes in there that feel personal, but I think that'll be part of the record's success, because I felt that there are many things in there that are quite relatable. You know, I think a lot of people Yeah, I think a lot of people will relate to the themes in this record. Of course, this is the first album to feature Steve on bass. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've been touring together for a couple of years now, but what's that like, having that new dynamic come in into the studio and having a fresh face to work with?
It's cool, man. You know, it's different, because obviously it's a different person, but it's great, you know. And it's that what I love about Steve, man, is he got the dog in him. Like, he's one of those guys where, like, he'll play something like, damn, that's pretty good. He's like, nope, fucked it up. Got to do it again. Mm-hmm. And, like, he's calling himself out, you know, and it's just like, but he's that dude, man. He's going to grind, but he's going to play his ass off and sing his ass off and do his thing. And I don't know, man. It's kind of like, imagine your favorite, what's your favorite sport?
Mine,
you're a football
would be,
guy?
What you would class as soccer?
We'll call it football for y'all's sake. Okay. We'll call it football. So you're a football guy. So imagine your team has been it's been great forever. Mm-hmm. But one guy retires, and then you guys pick up on waivers from free agency this guy that is like the next biggest rookie in the making. That's what it feels like.
Yeah, yeah.
If that can make sense, you know, like, if you compared it to sports world, it'd be like that. It'd be like, you know, having the number one top prospect in all of sports coming in with that kind of mentality. That's the kind of mentality that Steve brings in, is that, you know, that kind of work ethic, that kind of mentality of get it done, do it right, make sure it's right.
Obviously, we mentioned that it's the eighth studio album, and you said that, you know, it's more of a kind of a personal record. Did you, you know, when you went into that studio, did you look to approach this album any differently compared to your previous releases?
Just, we wanted to make sure that we kept the production. For me personally, I just didn't want to overdo anything, you know, like add parts that need adding and do cool shit here and there, but didn't want to add anything that just was unnecessary. Wanted to kind of keep the songs at the root of them, what they're going to be when you hear them live. I mean, obviously in the studio, you want to spruce things up. If not, you're not using the studio to its full potential. You know, that's why it's the studio. You have studio and then live, because I'm a firm believer that a live version of a song is the live version, and the studio version is a studio version. They both have different intricacies and different uniquenesses about them, but they're two different versions, man. You know, it's the live version is like, it's kind of like if you had a guide map from the studio version. Studio version is forever, but for live, it's like the guide map of how the song goes. Cause chances are I'm going to fuck something up at least once a night. Truth. It happens.
I mean, there is that thing where I feel in a live show, you get that special thing where, you know, like there's something a bit different, but I think that's what makes a live show special. You know, like I wouldn't want it to be exactly the same as the record. I don't think, because I think at the end of like you can walk away at the end of the night and it feels like that's your experience.
100%. I love that. Like, I love when a band does something a little different, you know, one night on tour, or they do it, you know, or like if something, they do this, but then this song does this, or, you know, like, I don't know. like calling people out in the middle of a song where we're kind of jamming for a minute. Shit like that's fun to me to do some nights. You know, just you read the room and see how it's going. It's just fun.
One of my personal favorites on the album is Show Me What It Feels Like. I feel like it shows a bit of a different side to Blackstone that we haven't really heard before sonically. Could you talk a bit about that that track and how it came about?
Yeah, dude, that was one of the first things that the four of us wrote together after Steve joined us. We were at Soundcheck in Wisconsin, best I remember, and we kind of had this the intro riff. Like once the song comes in full on, we kind of had that part going, and then we got the starty stoppy part going, and it was kind of just figuring out the verse after that, because the chorus, we kind of knew we wanted the chorus to be just a couple chords, super simple, because we were playing the Show Me What It Feels Like, we were playing all that on the guitar at Soundcheck, and we just kind of translated it all, and it was once we got that verse vibe, you know, just kind of settled it in to get it to where it was one of these kind of things where your head just keeps moving and it does it on its own, right? Like you almost like a little bobblehead sitting on a dash somewhere. But it once we got that going, man, it was like, okay, this is like a sexy kind of song, you know, and we're like a swampy, heavy, tinge of Southern here and there, you know, kind of band. And but I actually love how that song came out. It's like, I don't know, it gives me kind of like heavy metal Prince vibes or something. It's just, I love that song.
It's just very catchy, and it stood out to me because as I mentioned there, I do feel it's something you haven't done before, you know, like, and
being I would agree with that.
Being 8 albums deep as well, I think, you know, it's, I imagine that that might be a bit difficult to come up with something at that point that's like completely different.
I don't know. Everything comes in waves, you know what I mean? Like the inspiration strikes at different times and for different, a different riff will come out on a different day. You know, had that been say it was a Tuesday, if it would have been Wednesday and 30 minutes earlier, it might have been a totally different riff. You never know.
Very true.
Every idea is worth exploring though.
It's absolutely. One of your other singles, Out of Pocket, obviously that's becoming quite a popular track already. Was this something that you thought would be a hit as soon as you heard it or played it?
I knew it felt good. Whenever we finished that song, I knew that when we listened back to it and the chorus came on, you know, after, because it's another kind of different thing where we start the song with the chorus music, which we don't typically do. And then the verse kind of has the drop down with the really funky bass and stuff. But it's like, it just kind of set a vibe. And that was the first song we actually finished writing for this entire record was Out of Pocket. It was the first one that was kind of buttoned up, fastened. There's a badass banger song to get us started. But like the minute it came on, you know, just the kung, 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 we were, everybody was already kind of like, okay, this has got a vibe about it, you know, and it wasn't just like, it's cool with the groove and heavy. Like there was an energy and like a, I don't know, like almost an anxiousness about it that was, but in a good way.
Yeah.
That song, and I think it's connected with people lyrically, because who didn't feel out of pocket at some point over the last couple of years, you know, and felt the struggle and the grind of the world being shut down and the pandemic and the grip it had on everyone. You know, I think we've all got to feeling, you know, not in our lane as much as we used to be at some point.
Obviously we touched on it at the beginning. You have a series of kind of more intimate UK shows around the corner starting on the 26th of September. What was that decision? What was that decision behind going for these kind of intimate venues? I mean, obviously, not that long ago, you guys were at the Royal Albert Hall. I mean, that was
it's something I've wanted to do. That's why I said I'm fucking pumped. It's something I've wanted to do for a while now. Don't get me wrong, I love the arenas. You know, we did those in January, and it's good fun. But I like the rooms where I can point it, like even, like, and I use this room as a bigger example, like the Apollo in Manchester. I could stand on stage there, point at the person at the very back, they can point back at me, and we're having that connection, right? It's harder to do that in an arena, and I mean, it's not impossible, but it's harder to do. But I've always wanted to go back and play the rooms we played on the very first tour we ever did. Now, the Astoria is long gone, unfortunately, so we're doing a different venue in London. But some of these venues, man, were some of the first venues we ever played the first couple of tours over there. And it's just something I've always thought would be cool. Like, you know, no opener, just we go in and we play a normal, you know, 90-minute show, Blackstone Cherry show, in the smallest rooms over there that we've played. I don't know, we haven't played them since 2008, probably, most of these rooms.
I mean, I'll be there at Nottingham, the Rescue.
Yeah, man.
That's, I was surprised, like, when it first came out. It's a 450 cap venue. And I was like, wow.
I am pumped,
like,
about it, man.
Like, it's going to be exciting, dude, I feel. Yeah.
Dude, I remember playing the Academy 3s are the small ones, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember playing, doing the Academy 3s. I remember doing in Nottingham, we did the basement at Rock City, the little small room down there. But dude, like, Rock City is one of those rooms that I absolutely love. I love that room. Mm. It's just good rock and roll fun, man. It's going to be loud. It's going to be sweaty, and it's going to be a good time.
It will be. A question I always like to finish on that I ask every guest that comes on. It's a bit of a hypothetical one. If you could tour with one band from the past and one band from the present, who would they be?
I'm going to go with the 1977 lineup of Lynyrd Skynyrd. Didn't see that one coming, I bet. The hat. And then band from the present. Man, I'm going to... That's tough because, like, the super heavy music fan in me would be like Gojira or Sleep Token, which I don't think we're heavy enough to play with either one of those, probably. But then the country music fan in me is like, it'd be badass to go out and tour with somebody like Tyler Childers, just to see how a tour like that would go. But man, I'm going to go with a band from the present.
Everybody really struggles with that.
I would probably have to say Metallica. And the reason I say that is, look, I know at Metallica shows that people are coming in while the other bands are playing, you know, and it's like that when you play with really, really big bands, you know, that a lot of the people don't get off work. You have to play earlier. People are getting off work coming in. It's still a great time. You're still playing for an insanely large amount of people, but it's like the place isn't jam packed till Metallica hits or somebody like that, you know, or AC/DC, for example. But man, I remember as a kid getting the Load record, and that being my big introduction to Metallica was King Nothing and the Black Album.
I had the same.
See, and like a lot of people are like, oh, fuck, the battery or die. And I'm like, I get it. I really do. I get it. Because the band that I fell in love with is not the same Metallica that you fell in love with. But dude, there's something about Load, Reload, Garage Inc., and the Black Album that, being a kid that was born in 1985, those records changed my life. And I can honestly say Load is the record that made me want to play like heavier rock and roll. That was the record that made me want to turn the distortion on my amp and play that kind of music.
That's a solid one. I mean, I'll throw it in now. Is that kind of part of the inspiration for the Blackstone riffs? You know, obviously you guys have quite a lot of like badass riffs going on.
I mean, Hetfield's the riff lord, but yeah, like it. One thing has to be for certain. Our songs either have to have, in our opinion, people are entitled to their own opinions, but in our opinion, our songs have to have a badass riff and a badass melody, or they're not a Blackstone Church song. Mm. That's just the way me and Ben think, though. Like, we're guitar players first. Like I said earlier, man, I'm a guitar player first. So the riff, you know, that on the front of one of those Down records, it says, "The power of the riff compels me," and I could not agree more. It's the power of the riff, man. Tony Iommi is another huge influence as far as riffs go.
Mm.
You know, Tony and James Hetfield, and honest to God, Tom Morello is another huge influence with the riffs. All that Audio Slave and Rage Against the Machine stuff. That's, granted, it's way funkier than what we do. Mm. But what's cool, man, is when you start going back and listening to, like, all the Parliament Funkadelic stuff and all that, like, that era of funk, and you listen to how Tom Morello would borrow from those riffs and stuff and slow them down, and you're like, it makes sense, man. It's so cool.
Mm.
It's the same thing with Metallica, though, and like King Diamond, stuff like that. You know, it just, you trace stuff back, and that's where the fun comes in.
Mm. I mean, that's always been something that I found really interesting about you guys. You know, obviously you're like a Southern band, but you have these influences clearly from multiple places. And I remember at the time it was like, there's no other band quite like you guys. And I don't think there is now.
I appreciate that. I feel like we've really gotten back to that with this record, you know.
Mm.
Dude, you tour and you write songs and you do all those things, and it's, you know, you live and learn. And but I feel like this record is, more than anything, it's the most honest and free sounding record. And that was what I loved about our first record, is it just sounded kind of free, you know, like open and wild, and like it didn't really have any chains on it.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Chris. And
yes, sir. Course, thank you.
Of course, for those that want to pre-order the brand new album, Screaming at the Sky, you can get that via the link in the description below. And if there is any tickets left for this little tour, I don't know if there actually is, but if you're able to grab them, yeah, if you can, I mean, be my guest to try the link below. But
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know in Nottingham it sold out in like 3 minutes.
Dude, it was ridiculous. And that was one of the only worries we had, was making sure people got the tickets. And hopefully that's the case. I hope the people were able to get tickets and not the fucking touts.
Yeah.
Because I hate that shit. I hate it worse than anything, man.
Yeah, I agree, man. But yeah, I know quite a few people that managed to get them. So
awesome. Man, we'll see you in Nottingham. Thanks
absolutely
so much.
Absolutely. It'll be for my 30th birthday, believe it or not.
Awesome. Come on now.
Thanks very much, man.